92. Keep forever. Suddenly the door, which was always crashed shut, opened quite noiselessly. The long-faced guard stood in the narrow opening and, from inside the cell, not from the corridor, asked in a menacing growl, "What's all this banging?" Innocenti was relieved. If the guard was not afraid to enter, there was no risk of poisoning yet. "I'm not feeling well," he said hesitantly. "Give me some water." "Well, just remember," the guard said sternly. "No banging in any circumstances, otherwise you'll be punished."
"But what if I feel ill? If I need to call somebody?"
"And don't raise your voice. What you do if you need to call somebody," the guard explained in his sullen drawl, "is you wait till the peephole opens and raise a finger without speaking." He backed out and locked the door. The machine beyond the wall started up, then fell silent. The door opened again, this time with a clatter. It dawned on Innocenti that they were trained to open doors noisily or quietly as required. The guard gave him a mug of water.
"Listen," said Innocenti, taking the mug. "I'm unwell. I need to lie down."
"Not allowed in the box."
"Where? Not allowed where?"
He needed to talk to somebody. Even this blockhead would do.
But the guard had already backed out of the cell and was closing the door. Innocenti pulled himself together.
"Listen, call your superior officer. Why have I been arrested?"
The door was locked.
"In the box," he had said, using the English word.
So that's their cynical term for this sort of cell. Accurate enough, I suppose.
Innocenti took a sip of water. He lost his thirst at once. The mug's capacity was 300 grams. It was enameled, greenish, with a strange picture of a cat wearing glasses, pretending to read a book, but furtively eyeing a cheeky bird hopping around nearby. They couldn't, surely, have chosen this picture especially for the Lubyanka. But how apt it was. The cat was the Soviet regime, the book the Stalin constitution, and the sparrow a thinking individual. Innocenti could not suppress a wry smile, and this suddenly brought home to him the immensity of the disaster that had befallen him. He would never have believed himself capable of smiling after less than a half hour in the Lubyanka's dungeons. It was worse for Shevronik in the neighbouring box. It would have taken more than a cat to raise a smile from him right then. Moving his overcoat to make room, Innocenti put the mug on the table. The lock clattered. The door opened. A lieutenant entered holding a piece of paper. The sergeant's joyless face could be seen behind him. Innocenti, in his dove-grey diplomatic uniform embroidered with gold palm leaves, rose unhurriedly to meet him.
"Listen, lieutenant, what is this all about? Is there some misunderstanding? Let me see the warrant. I didn't read it properly."
"Surname?" the lieutenant asked tonelessly, looking glassy-eyed at Innocenti.
"Volodin,"
Innocenti conceded, eager to clarify the situation.
"First name, patronymic?"
"Innocenti Artemyevich."
"Year of birth?"
The lieutenant kept referring to his piece of paper.
1919. "Place of birth?"
"Leningrad."
And with that, just when the time for explanations had arrived and the counselor, second class, was expecting them, the lieutenant withdrew and the door closed, almost pinching the counselor. Innocenti sat down and shut his eyes. He was beginning to feel the power of those mechanical claws. The machine started humming. Then silence. Things great and small came into his mind, all of them so urgent an hour ago that his legs ached to be up and doing. Here in the box there was no room to take a single full step, let alone to run. The flap of the spyhole moved. Innocenti raised a finger. The door was opened by the woman with blue epaulets and a stupid, heavy face.
"I want to... you know," he said meaningfully.
"Hands behind your back. Move it,"
the woman snapped. And Innocenti, obeying her nod, went out into the corridor, which seemed pleasantly cool after the stuffiness of the box. After a short walk, the woman nodded at a door.
"In here."
He went in. The door was locked behind him. There was an aperture in the floor, and two iron footrests. Otherwise, the minimal floor space and the walls of this little cell were covered with red tiles. Water splashed refreshingly in the depths. Glad that here at least he would get a rest from uninterrupted surveillance, Innocenti squatted. But he heard a click from the other side of the door, looked up and saw that here too there was a conical spy hole, and that the importunate eye was watching him closely, not at intervals, but continuously. Embarrassed, Innocenti stood up. The door was flung open before he could raise his finger to say, "Ready."
"Hands behind. Move,"
the woman said calmly. Back in the box, Innocenti felt a sudden need to know the time. Unthinkingly, he pulled back his cuff, but the time was no longer there. He sighed and began studying the cat on the mug, but before he got lost in thought, the door was unlocked, and someone new, a fat-faced, broad-shouldered fellow in a grey smock, asked him his name.
"I've already answered that," Innocenti said indignantly.
"Name?"
the newcomer repeated tonelessly, like a radio operator calling another station.
"Oh, well. Volodin.
Pick up your things. Walk,"
Grey Smock said impassively. Innocenti took his overcoat and cap from the little table and walked. He was pointed toward the room he had entered first, and in which his epaulets had been ripped off and his watch and notebooks taken from him. The pocket handkerchief was no longer lying on the floor.
"Listen, my belongings have been taken from me," he complained.
"Undress,"
was the reply from the guard in the grey smock. Innocenti was flabbergasted.
"What for?"
he asked. The guard looked him sternly in the eye.
"You Russian?"
he asked harshly.
"Yes."
Innocenti, never at a loss for words, could think of nothing else to say.
"Undress."
"Don't non-Russians have to, then?"
A dismal attempt at humour. The guard maintained a stony silence and waited. Innocenti assumed a contemptuous smile, shrugged, sat down on the stool, took off his shoes, then his uniform, and offered it to the guard. He attached no ritual importance to uniforms, but nonetheless felt a certain respect for his gold-trimmed garments.
"Drop it,"
said Grey Smock, pointing to the floor. Innocenti hesitated. The guard wrested the tawdry uniform from him, flung it on the floor, and barked,
"Naked."
"What do you mean, naked?"
"Naked."
"But that's completely impossible, comrade. It's cold here, you know."
"You'll be stripped forcibly,"
the guard warned him. Innocenti thought a while. They had assaulted him once, and it looked as though they would assault him again. Shivering with cold and disgust, he removed his silk underwear and obediently tossed it onto the same heap.
"Socks off."
Innocenti removed his socks and stood barefoot on the wooden floor. His legs were hairless and a delicate white, like the rest of his unresisting body.
"Open your mouth. Wider. Say ah. Again. Longer. Ah. Now raise your tongue."
As though Innocenti were a horse for sale, the guard's dirty fingers plucked at one of his cheeks, then the other, the pouch under one eye, the pouch under the other, reassured himself that nothing was hidden under the tongue, inside the cheeks, or in the eyes, tipped Innocenti's head back with a firm push so that the light shone into his nostrils, inspected both ears, tugging at the lobes, ordered him to spread his fingers, ascertained that there was nothing between them, and made him flap his arms to check that there was nothing under his armpits either. Then, in the same unanswerable, robotic voice,
"Take your member in your hands. Turn back the skin. Father. Right, that's enough. Move your member to the right and upward. To the left and upward. Right, let go. Stand with your back to me. Legs apart. Wider. Bend over and touch the floor. Legs wider apart. Part your buttocks with your hands. Right. Good. Now squat. Quickly. Once more."
Whenever he had thought about being arrested, Innocenti had visualized a furious intellectual duel with Leviathan, the state. He was keyed up, ready to defend heroically his life and beliefs. He had never imagined that it would all be so crude, so stupid, and so ineluctable. The people waiting for him in the Lubyanka, low-ranking, obtuse people, were uninterested in him as an individual, and in the act that had brought him there, but had a zealous concern for trivialities that took him by surprise and left him helpless. And anyway, what form could resistance take, and where would it get him? The repeated demands they made on him seemed so insignificant compared with the great battle ahead that it was not worth digging his heels in. But the details of this nonsensical procedure taken together served to break the will of the newly arrested prisoner. So Innocenti bore all these indignities in dejected silence. The searcher silently indicated a stool nearer the door, on which Innocenti, still naked, was to sit. He disliked the idea of contact between his naked body and this new cold object. But as soon as he sat down, he was pleasantly surprised to find that the wooden stool seemed to impart some warmth. Innocenti had experienced many acute pleasures in his life, but this was something new. Pressing his elbows to his chest and drawing his knees up higher, he felt still warmer. While he sat like that, the searcher stood over the heap of clothing, shaking, probing, holding things up to the light. He was kind enough not to detain the underpants and socks for long. With the underpants he just felt along the ribs and seams, pinch by pinch, then tossed them at Innocenti's feet. The socks he detached from their elastic garters, turned inside out, and tossed to Innocenti. After feeling the seams and folds of the undershirt, he tossed that, too, in the direction of the door, so that Innocenti could now dress, making his body still more blissfully warm. The searcher then took out a big pocket knife with a crude wooden handle, opened it, and got to work on the shoes. He disdainfully ejected the fragments of pencil, and repeatedly flexed the soles with a look of intense concentration, searching for anything hard concealed there. Slitting the insole with his knife, he did in fact tease out a small piece of steel and placed it on the table. Then he picked up an awl and drove it right through one heel. Innocenti watched him intently as he worked, and was able to think how sick he must get of fingering other people's underwear, cutting up their footwear, and peering into their back passages year after year. That must be why the searcher had such a grim, forbidding look on his face. But the misery and tedium of watching and waiting snuffed out these flickerings of ironic thought. The searcher began stripping the gold facings, the service buttons, and collar tabs from Innocenti's uniform. Then he slit open the lining and felt under it. He took as long again over the creases and seams of Innocenti's trousers. The winter overcoat gave him still more trouble. Deep down in the padding he seemed to hear a rustle, not that of padding. A note sewn in there? Addresses? An ampoule of poison? And, ripping open the lining, he searched lengthily, wearing a look of such concentration and concern that he might have been operating on a human heart. The search took a long time, perhaps over an hour. At last the searcher gathered up his trophies, braces, elastic garters. He had already told Innocenti that these were not allowed in prison. Tie, tie-pin, cufflinks, the piece of steel from the welt of his shoe, two fragments of pencil, the gold facings, all the decorations from the uniform, and several buttons. Only then did Innocenti fully realize how thoroughly the man had done his destructive work. Of all the indignities heaped upon him that evening, the worst was not the slits in the soles of his shoes, not the ripped lining, not the padding sticking out from the armpits of his overcoat, no, the absence of almost all of his buttons, when they had already deprived him of suspenders, was the affront that Innocenti felt most acutely. "Why have you cut off my buttons?" he exclaimed.
"Not allowed," the guard growled.
"What do you mean? How am I supposed to go around, then?"
"Tie yourself up with string," the man answered sullenly, already at the door.
"What nonsense is this? What string? Where am I supposed to get it from?" But the door was slammed and locked. Innocenti refrained from knocking and arguing. He had to think himself lucky that they had left him buttons on his overcoat, and one or two elsewhere. He was proving to be a quick learner. He had not had long to enjoy the spaciousness of his new quarters, clutching his trouser tops as he walked around to stretch his legs, when the key grated in the lock again and a new guard appeared. This one wore a white smock, not, however, of the first freshness. He looked at Innocenti as if he were some long familiar object that had always been in this room, and abruptly ordered him to strip naked. Innocenti wanted to answer indignantly, to sound threatening, but he was choking with resentment, and could only utter a feeble squawk of protest. "But I've just stripped once. Couldn't somebody have warned me?" Obviously not, because the new arrival simply waited, with a blank, bored look, for him to carry out the order. What surprised Innocenti most in those he met here was their ability to remain silent where normal people usually respond. He was getting used to the rhythmic routine of implicit and automatic obedience. He took off his shoes and undressed. "Sit." The guard pointed to the stool on which Innocenti had sat for so long already. The naked prisoner sat submissively, without wondering why. The free man's habit of thinking over his actions before performing them was atrophying fast, now that others were thinking so effectively for him. The guard's fingers gripped the nape of the prisoner's neck roughly. The cold, cutting edge of a machine was pressed hard against the top of his head. Innocenti winced.
"What are you doing?" he said,
making a feeble effort to free himself from the clutching fingers.
"What right have you to do this? I'm not under arrest yet."
He meant that he had not been formally charged. But the barber did not relax his grip. He went on shearing. The spark of rebellion fizzled out. The proud young diplomat, used to alighting nonchalantly from intercontinental aircraft, gazing absently through half-closed eyes at the daytime dazzle of bustling European capitals, was now merely a naked male person, all skin and bones, and with a half-shaven head. Innocenti's silky, light-brown hair fell as sadly and soundlessly as snowflakes. He caught one wisp and rubbed it gently between his fingers. He was full of love for himself and the life that was leaving him. He remembered deciding that submissiveness would be interpreted as an admission of guilt. He remembered resolving to resist, to protest, to argue, to demand to see the prosecutor. But against all reason, he was helpless, paralyzed by the pleasurable indifference of a man freezing in the snow. The barber finished shaving his head, then made him stand and raise his arms one by one, and shaved his armpits. He then squatted and began shaving off Innocenti's pubic hair. This was a new sensation. It tickled. Innocenti involuntarily shrank, and the barber made an impatient noise.
"May I dress now?"
Innocenti asked when the procedure was over. But the barber left without a word, locking the door behind him. A crafty inner voice told Innocenti not to get dressed in a hurry this time. He felt an unpleasant prickling in the newly shaved tender spots. Running his hand over a head that seemed unfamiliar, he could not remember being close-cropped since childhood, he felt a strange prickly stubble and bumps on his skull that he had not known about. He decided to put on his underwear after all, and was about to slip into his trousers when the lock rattled and yet another guard came in, one with a purple, fleshy nose. He was carrying a large piece of cardboard.
"Name?"
"Volodin,"
the prisoner answered. He had given up resisting these senseless, sickening repetitions.
"First name and patronymic?"
"Innocenti Artemovich."
"Year of birth?"
1919.
"Place of birth?"
"Leningrad."
"Strip naked?"
Scarcely realizing what was happening, he took off the rest of his clothes. His undershirt, which he had placed on the edge of the table, fell onto the dirty floor, but he did not stoop to pick it up. The purple-nosed guard inspected Innocenti minutely from various angles, systematically recording his findings on his index card. His close attention to birthmarks and facial details told Innocenti that these characteristics were now a matter of record. This one left in turn. Innocenti sat limply on his stool and made no effort to dress. The door rattled again. A stout, dark-haired woman in a snow-white smock came in. Her voice was coarse and forbidding, her comportment that of an educated person. Innocenti pulled himself together, reached quickly for his underpants and half-concealed his nakedness. But the woman darted a contemptuous, utterly unfeminine glance at him, and, thrusting even further her jutting lower lip, asked,
"You, have you got lice?"
Innocenti, offended, looked straight into her black eyes and, still holding his underpants together in front of him, said, "I'm a diplomat."
"What's that got to do with anything? Do you have any complaints?"
"I want to know why I've been arrested. I want to read the warrant. I want to see the prosecutor," Innocenti blurted out.
The woman frowned.
"You misunderstood my question," she said wearily.
"No venereal diseases?"
"What?
Have you ever had gonorrhea, syphilis, or soft canker? Leprosy? Tuberculosis? Any other complaints?"
She left, without waiting for an answer. The very first guard, the one with the long face, came in. Innocenti was almost pleased to see him. This one had not insulted or harmed him.
"Why aren't you getting your clothes on?" the guard asked gruffly. "Get dressed quickly."
Easier said than done. Alone and locked in again, Innocenti struggled to keep his trousers up with no suspenders and several buttons missing. Unable to draw on the experience of dozens of generations of prisoners, Innocenti knitted his brow and solved the problem unaided, as millions of his predecessors had done before him. He must use his shoelaces to tie around his waist and hold his fly together. Only now did he look closely enough to see that the metal tips had been torn off his laces. Why did they go to such lengths? Unknown to Innocenti, the Lubyanka's standing orders allowed for the possibility that a prisoner might use one of these tips as a suicide weapon. He did not even try to tie the jacket of his uniform together. The sergeant looked through the spy hole to check that the prisoner was dressed, unlocked the door, ordered him to keep his hands behind his back, and led him to yet another room. There, Innocenti found his old acquaintance, the guard with the purple nose.
"Shoes off," he said by way of greeting.
This was no longer a problem. The shoes, now without laces, fell off unaided, and the socks, without their elastic garters, slipped down around his ankles. A contraption with a vertical white gauge for measuring height stood by the wall. Purple Nose shepherded Innocenti toward it, lowered the movable bar onto his head, and recorded his height.
"You can put your shoes on," he said.
While the long-faced one at the door admonished him,
"Hands behind your back."
Hands behind your back. Although box number 8 was only 2 steps away, diagonally across the corridor. Innocenti was locked up in his box again. The mysterious machine on the other side of the wall was still alternately revving up and falling silent. Innocenti slumped limply onto the stool, holding his overcoat. From the moment he had landed in the Lubyanka, he had seen nothing but blinding electric light, cramped rooms between tight walls, and silent, impassive jailers. The procedures, each more absurd than the last, seemed to him a cruel farce. He did not realize that they formed a logically calculated sequence. The preliminary body search by the operatives who arrested him, establishment of the prisoner's identity, receipt of the prisoner, not presented in person, acknowledged by the prison administration, initial prison body search on receipt, preliminary hygienic treatment, recording of marks on body, medical examination. These procedures had left him dizzy, robbed him of his ability to think straight and the will to resist. He was tormented now by one desire, to sleep. He decided that they were leaving him in peace for the time being. His first 3 hours in the Lubyanka had given him a new view of things, and he saw that there was only one way to make himself at home, by putting the stool on top of the table, throwing his exquisite overcoat with the astrakhan collar on the floor, and lying down on it diagonally across the box. This meant that his back was on the floor, his head raised and wedged awkwardly in one corner of the box, and his legs, bent at the knees, twisted to fit into the opposite corner. Still, for a little while, until his limbs became numb, it was bliss. But before he could sink into a deep sleep, someone flung open the door, deliberately making as much noise as possible. A woman growled, "Get up!" Innocenti scarcely batted an eyelid.
"Get up, get up!"
the voice overhead commanded.
"Suppose I want to sleep."
"Get up!"
the woman thundered, hovering over him like a gorgon in a nightmare. From his contorted position, Innocenti had difficulty rising to his feet.
"So take me where I can lie down and sleep a bit," he said feebly.
"Not permitted,"
The Gorgon with the light blue epaulette snapped back and slammed the door. Innocenti propped himself up against the wall and waited while she opened the spy hole once, twice, three times, and studied him at length. He took advantage of her departure to sink back onto his overcoat. He was losing consciousness when the door crashed open again. Another big, strong fellow in a white smock stood on the threshold. He would have made a heroic blacksmith or quarryman.
Name?
He asked.
Volodin.
Bring your things. Innocenti scooped up his coat and cap from the floor and, with eyes glazing over, followed the guard on unsteady legs. He was utterly exhausted, and his feet were so numb that he could not tell whether the floor beneath him was even or not. He could hardly muster the strength to move, and felt like lying down right there in the middle of the corridor. He was led through a narrow opening bashed in the thick wall into another, dirtier corridor, where they opened a door into the anteroom to the shower room, handed him a piece of coarse soap smaller than a matchbox, and ordered him to wash. Innocenti was reluctant to obey. He was used to tiled bathrooms with surfaces like polished mirrors, and this wooden dressing room, which might have seemed clean enough to most people, struck him as nauseatingly dirty. He forced himself to find a sufficiently dry place on the bench, undressed, and walked queasily over the wet grating that bore the prints of bare feet and shoes. He would have been glad not to undress and wash at all, but the door of the anteroom opened and the blacksmith in the white smock ordered him to get under the shower. A flimsy, unprison-like door with two unglazed slits in it opened onto the shower room. There were four gratings, which Innocenti decided were also dirty, and over them four showers. The hot and cold water were just right, but Innocenti was not a bit grateful. Four showers for the use of one man. But Innocenti felt no happier. He might have appreciated his 16-fold advantage more if he had known that four men under a single shower was more usual in the Zex world. The evil-smelling soap they had given him, he had handled nothing like it in his 30 years, indeed had never realized that such a thing existed. He had abandoned with a shudder in the dressing room. He splashed about for a minute or two, mainly to wash off hairs left behind by the clippers, which were prickling him in tender places. Then, feeling that he had not washed but gotten dirtier, went back to dress. Or so he thought. But the benches in the dressing room were bare. His splendid, though now mutilated, garments had been taken away, and only his shoes remained, hiding their noses under benches. The outer door was locked, and the spy hole was covered with its disc. All Innocenti could do was sit on the bench, statuesquely naked, like Rodin's thinker, and meditate while he dried off. After a while he was given coarse underwear, the worse for frequent laundering, with the words "inner prison" stamped in black on the back and the belly, and a square rag with a crisscross pattern bearing the same stamp and folded in four, which he did not immediately identify as a towel. The buttons on the undergarments were of stiffened cloth. Some buttons were missing, and some of the tapes had been torn off. The skimpy drawers were too short and too tight for Innocenti, and pinched him between the legs. The shirt, on the other hand, was very roomy, and the sleeves came down over his fingers. They refused to exchange these underclothes, arguing that Innocenti had already spoiled one set by putting them on. Wearing his ill-fitting underwear, Innocenti was left sitting in the dressing room for a long time. He was told that his outer garments were still in the cooker. The word was new to Innocenti. Even during the war, when the whole country was dotted with heat sterilization rooms, he had never come across them. But the cooking of his clothes was perfectly in line with the senseless indignities inflicted on him that night. He imagined a huge devil's frying pan. Innocenti tried soberly to consider his situation and what he should do. But his thoughts were kaleidoscopic. The tight drawers, the frying pan in which his tunic now lay, and the unblinking eye for which the lid of the spy hole frequently made way, chased one another and merged. The shower had driven sleep away, but a murderous weakness overcame him. He wanted to lie down on something dry and not cold, to lie there motionless, recovering the strength that was draining from him. But he could not bring himself to lie with his bare ribs against the wet, sharp-edged slats of the bench, They did not even run parallel. The door opened, but not because they had brought his clothes from the cooker. At the shower room guard side stood a girl with a big red face in civilian dress. Bashfully covering gaps in his underwear with his hands, Innocenti walked to the doorway. The girl ordered him to sign a copy and handed him a pink receipt. Items received for storage this day, December 26th, by the inner prison of the USSR Ministry of State Security from Volodin, IA. 1 yellow metal watch, number of watch, number of mechanism. 1 fountain pen trimmed with yellow metal and with matching nib. 1 tie pin with red stone inset. Cufflinks of blue stone, 1 pair. Again, Innocenti waited, drooping. At last, they brought his clothes. His overcoat was returned cold and undamaged, but his tunic, trousers and shirt were crumpled, discoloured and still hot. "Why couldn't they be as careful with the uniform as with the overcoat?" he asked indignantly. "The coat has fur bits," the blacksmith informed him. "Use your head." After heat sterilization, even his own clothes seemed alien and disgusting. Clad from head to foot in strange and uncomfortable things, Innocenti was led back to his box number 8. He asked for water and twice greedily drained the mug with the picture of the cat. After this, another young woman visited him, and, in return for his signature, gave him a bright blue receipt, reading, "This day, December 27th, received by the inner prison of the USSR Ministry of State Security from Volodin, IA, 1 silk undershirt, 1 pair silk drawers, suspenders, tie." The mysterious machine was still humming away. Left locked in again, Innocenti folded his arms on the table, laid his head on them, and tried to go to sleep sitting.
"Not allowed."
The door was unlocked by a new guard who had just taken over.
"What isn't?"
"Laying your head down."
Innocenti's muddled mind had expected worse. Another document was brought, this one on white paper, acknowledging receipt by the inner prison of the USSR Ministry of State Security of 123 rubles from Volodin, IA. Then another new face, a man in a blue smock over an expensive brown suit. Every time they brought a receipt, they asked his name. This time was no exception. Surname? First name and patronymic? Year of birth? Place of birth? After which the visitor ordered,
"All right, without."
"Without what?"
"Without your gear. Hands behind your back."
In the corridor, all orders were given in a low voice, so that those in other boxes would not hear. Clicking his tongue at that invisible dog, the man in the brown suit led Innocenti through the main exit, then along another corridor to a large room unlike the rest of the prison. Blinds were drawn over the windows, there was soft furniture, and there were desks. Innocenti was made to sit on a chair in the middle of the room. "This," he thought, "is when they interrogate me. Deny it. Deny absolutely everything. Deny with all your might." But instead of that, a brown box camera was trundled out from behind a curtain. Bright lights were switched on to left and right of Innocenti, and he was photographed once full face and once in profile. The head guard who had escorted Innocenti took the fingers of his right hand one by one and pressed their tips against a sticky black cylinder that seemed to be coated with marking ink, so that all 5 fingertips were black. Then, parting Innocenti's fingers to leave equal spaces between them, the man in the blue smock pressed them heavily against a form and pulled them sharply away. 5 black prints with white whorls were left on the form. The fingers of his left hand were smeared and printed in the same way. Written on the form above the prints was, "Volodin, Innocenti Artemievich, 1919, Leningrad," and above that in heavy black print, "Keep permanently." Reading this instruction, Innocenti shuddered. There was something mystical in it, something that looked beyond the human race and the planet Earth. They gave him cold water, soap, and a little brush to wash his fingers. The sticky dye was not easy to remove by these means. The cold water simply trickled off it. Innocenti scrubbed his finger ends vigorously with the soaped brush. He did not ask himself whether the fingerprinting should logically have come before the bath. Exhausted and disoriented, His brain was in the grip of that overpowering cosmic formula. Keep permanently.